From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Well, we begin with excellent news. The United States is not at war with Australia. Yet. On Thursday, news consumers were treated to the details of a call between President Donald J. Trump and Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, which Trump cut off after insulting Turnbull about his country's refugee agreement with the United States.
The Washington Post reports the new US president candidly declared Australia's refugee agreement with Barack Obama the worst deal ever, said Australia was seeking to export the next Boston bombers.
This was the worst call by far, the president's quoted saying, after hanging up 25 minutes into a scheduled hour-long call.
News of this episode came hot on the heels of another scoop in which Trump did threaten to invade Mexico.
President Donald Trump says he would send troops into Mexico if they don't take care of, quote, bad hombres.
And there were reports that Trump's first actual use of military lethal force was a rushed, botched job.
The first major military operation authorized by Donald Trump, the target, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, and it didn't go as planned. It's now emerging that more civilians were killed, including women and children.
Apart from Trumpian bellicosity, North Korea and Iran also got threats this week. What did these stories have in common? Ah, none of them came from a Sean Spicer press statement. They were leaked, one and all, just as predicted here 2 weeks ago by Politico's Jack Schaefer.
It's a sure bet that there are bureaucrats who won't like the new direction of the new administrator and will be very, very willing to leak or to provide information that's valuable to whatever investigation a reporter might be pursuing.
In an administration trading daily in alternative facts, Schaefer said, it will be the leaks that offer a true window into Trump world. And it's already been a Peeping Tom's delight.
We were hearing from White House sources. They're telling CNN that the president was very unhappy with the way that the order, the executive order on travel restrictions, was executed.
ABC News has obtained a controversial draft executive order that's circulating apparently inside the White House there. It outlines a potential weakening of protections designed to shield LGBT individuals from discrimination.
A lot of people in various agencies are anonymously saying that Steve Bannon, Steve Miller, and others in the White House are advising the president more than the national security team.
The Washington Post's Chris Ciliza called this the leakiest White House he'd ever seen. Former New York Times editor Bill Keller said this week that Trump has created a, quote, government of fact checkers. For journalists like Politico's Ken Vogel, it's the infighting motherlode.
Oh, we are salivating. And in fact, the term that has been used to describe the situation now in the White House is it's like the Lord of the Flies in there. It's every person for themselves.
And the stories have gotten some traction, although they haven't necessarily broken through the clutter of the week's clownishness. All the world is chortling over Trump's Black History Month goof when he name-checked his African-American, Frederick Douglass.
Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
Yes, the abolitionist hero is doing an amazing job for someone who's been dead for 122 years. And much was made of Trump's hijacking of the National Prayer Breakfast to pray for Arnold Schwarzenegger's Celebrity Apprentice ratings. Meantime, while much of the press was focused on the sideshows, truly ominous activities were afoot. In order to impose a constitutionally dubious and otherwise abhorrent ban on Syrian refugees and citizens of seven majority Muslim countries, the White House undermined both other branches of government by hiding its intentions from Congress and by subverting a federal court order to cease deporting detained travelers. If you're a journalist covering Donald J. Trump, this might be a good time to pay less attention to trivial stupidities, juicy though they may be, and more on the documents being slid by anxious insiders and anonymous heroes under your door. Coming up, in search of objectivity in an objectively chaotic time. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. So many words aiming to describe journalistic fairness, balance, impartiality, objectivity, neutrality. Each is alone insufficient, but together they are at the core of many news organizations' policies on how journalists must comport themselves at work and off the clock as well. We can't post political opinions on social media. We can't put a politician's bumper sticker on our car or a sign on our lawn. And our spouses can't either. We definitely can't contribute to a political campaign. And if you are seen at a protest march, you had better have a notebook and pen in your hand. The point is to preserve dispassionate coverage, but even more, to keep you, the public, from doubting our motives and our reporting itself. But things have changed, haven't they? And some journalists, including some of the ones who make this show, have been questioning not only whether neutrality is possible, but whether it is even the correct journalistic value versus, perhaps, intellectual honesty and rigor. And that includes Lewis Wallace. Until this week, he was a reporter for the public radio show Marketplace. Last week, he wrote a post on Medium raising questions about the viability of neutrality in the face of a post-fact administration and imploring journalists to fight back. Wallace, a transgender man, wrote, quote, "Neutrality is impossible for me, and you should admit that it is for you, too." His Marketplace superiors suspended him for that, saying that the post violated the show's ethics guidelines, and they demanded that he take it down. He complied, but upon further reconsideration, he republished, and then Marketplace fired him, which he also wrote about on Medium. Lewis, welcome to On the Media.
Hi.
Objectivity is dead, and I'm okay with it, at least in the context of public broadcasting at this moment in history, as on the provocative side. But I've pored over the Marketplace ethics policy, looking for what part of it you might have violated, and came up mostly empty-handed, except for one thing, and that is the admonition to, quote, keep your political opinions to yourself. Now, you obviously steamrolled all over that one. But the question is, and I think it's the fundamental question of your piece, is it possible to honestly discuss journalistic values of truth and being proxy for the powerless and identifying injustice and so on without being in some way political?
Right. And I think what we do is political, and that in particular under the Trump administration, it's become more so because we have people in positions of authority saying phrases like alternative facts, routinely lying to the public about things. So the questions I think I was raising were about where is our moral center and the urgency of deciding where that is, you know, on the editorial side, essentially on the back end. But I would also argue on the front end, in terms of how we interact with the public, that I think the days where people believe that journalists are neutral and objective and sort of out of the mix are largely over. And that doesn't mean we should all become advocacy journalists and only do opinion pieces. We still need to do real hard reporting. And that's what my job was. And I loved it. But I don't think that we're benefiting the public or that we're building trust with the public by pretending that we're not asking these questions about what do we stand for in this moment when things are changing really fast.
No, I'm not suggesting you're out looking for trouble. However, marketplaces and public broadcasting. And there is a line in your piece that goes as follows. We will be called politically correct, liberal, and leftist. We shouldn't care about that, nor work to avoid it. And, you know, I could see how one of your managers would say, oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead, Lewis. Why not put a stake in the heart of public radio? Because this is exactly what the Republicans in Congress believe as they attempt to zero us out and get Radio Castro off the air once and for all.
I mean, I do think that that was the fear, in part. There was a fear about how that line would be perceived. And the argument that I was making is that the thing that we should be afraid of is a departure from truth and facts and a departure from reporting on the communities that public radio is in and is trying to represent. And that if one of the byproducts of having a moral center is that we're called politically correct or we're called liberals or we're called leftists, we just shouldn't worry about it. And I think part of why I feel comfortable saying that is because I have been called politically correct many times. Just because I'm a transgender person speaking up for myself kind of routinely in different situations, and I really don't have time to care. Like, I'm a busy journalist. I can't worry about that. Those of us who are marginalized can bring a lot to the table in terms of how do you be fair and honest and have integrity, and also when you need to fight back. And I'm used to sort of knowing where that moral compass is for me, because I've never had the privilege to have a really clear line between who I am and activism.
Now, there's another irony of your circumstances that kind of jaw-dropping. It's my understanding that your employers at Marketplace actually encouraged you to have a personal blog, to think out loud about subjects exactly like this. Was this the first piece that raised anybody's hackles?
It was, yeah. And I had been encouraged to keep a blog on Medium. I blogged a couple times for Marketplace about my process of reporting in the field and written about being trans and being a reporter, written about thinking about racism and anti-blackness while working in the field as a reporter. This was the first post that I'd written that was controversial with my managers, at least. I do find it ironic. I think what Marketplace is trying to do right now is what a lot of organizations are trying to do, which is have more of an identity and be known as more of a cutting-edge organization. The idea of having its reporters keep a blog and be out there is a piece of that. And I was talking to another trans reporter who said, you know, what are you going to blog about if not these things? And that's kind of how I felt. You know, that's who I am.
What's been the reaction?
Overall, what I've been hearing is journalists saying, hey, yeah, we all know that objectivity and neutrality are shape-shifting ideas that in some ways have been sort of conceptually debunked long ago, and we do need new strategies and we need to be talking about it. So that's largely been the reaction, which to me has been really inspiring. And that is why I decided to be public about this, because I never had any desire to disparage an organization that I believe in the mission of, that's full of hardworking, incredible, smart people. But I do think this conversation is important. And if anything, that has been echoed many times, including from people who said, I've been afraid that I would be fired or my integrity would be questioned if I brought this up, but it's something I've been thinking about.
Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lewis Wallace, until a few days ago, was a journalist for Marketplace. Marketplace's Senior Vice President and Executive Producer Deborah Clark declined our request for an interview. Marketplace decided to hold tight to a traditional ethics policy. Others are rewriting the rules, among them MIC, that's M-I-C, short for microphone, a liberal-minded news and commentary website aimed at and run by millennials. Kerry Lauerman is MIC's Executive News Director. Kerry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, back in the old days, and by the old days, I mean November, your team wouldn't have been permitted to go to the Women's March and hold signs and otherwise display solidarity with what is fundamentally a political movement. Mm-hmm. That's changed, no?
With the Women's March, we did allow staffers, when they came to us and asked if it was okay to participate in it, we said yes, you know, within reason. In that case, while clearly a response to the election, the larger tenets of the Women's March were so broad and covered areas kind of so universally accepted from, you know, wage equity onward, I think it's a little ludicrous to expect people, you know, even journalists, to not engage in the democratic process.
I get it that these are areas that you've identified as broad-based consensus issues, but some would argue that they're not consensus issues at all, that they cleave very much down standard political lines. So how do you make that list?
Sure. I think some of the ones would be pretty easy to mark off right away. You know, basic women's equity, that's pretty easy. Mike is a pretty modern company in terms of supporting LGBTQ rights. And so somebody who wanted to attend a basic speech promoting that, we would feel perfectly comfortable with. But I think, you know, a march for immigration rights may be one thing. A march that's specifically attacking Donald Trump's executive order from last week would be another.
Now, the publication itself, to scroll through it, offers a lot of, if not explicitly partisan content, at least content that very much holds Trump and his administration up to criticism, disparagement, even ridicule. I guess what I'm wondering is, do you cleave to ethical purity more by being open to your inclinations or by hiding them behind a veil of supposed objectivity?
I think faking it for objectivity's sake is a big mistake, and we encourage people to be incredibly transparent and clear about where they're coming from. We have a reporter, Aaron Morrison, who has been deeply embedded over the course of the last year or more in the movement for Black Lives, and he's done it pretty dispassionately and very clear-eyed. I don't think you could read his coverage and feel he's creating a false sense of objectivity. He's simply trying to get at the truth, and I think that's still the greatest goal.
Mike, like many newsrooms, makes its business to have a diverse staff for a variety of reasons, not just social equity, but for journalistic ones too, to bring a lot of other life experiences and worldviews to bear on the coverage of events. Another way of saying that is to have subjectivity in your very staffing, which is maybe antithetical to any notion of objectivity itself?
Yeah. You know, Mike is a unique case because it really started off as a media company with diversity as a clear tenet. Unlike big media organizations that I know I've belonged to in the past, it's not something that you have to try to suddenly embrace decades and decades after ignoring it. Mike's staff is incredibly diverse in every way possible. I see that nothing but a huge advantage of ours. I do think it's exactly those virtues which make the idea of objectivity as though it's this sort of, you know, most pristine goal that anyone can achieve. It makes it seem a little ridiculous. We're stronger by having people with different points of view approach things with those points of view. That doesn't mean that they can't approach them open-mindedly and fairly. So, yeah, it probably does further erode this sort of old-fashioned notion of objectivity. But I think that's better for journalism, too.
Kerry, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Kerry Lauerman is executive news editor for Mike. That's MIC.com. Now we want to know what you think. And what we most want to know is, do you want to know what we think? Should journalists strive for balance, objectivity, and impartiality? And what if that deserves our job to provide meaning and context? Should we pipe down on Twitter, or should we be transparent about our viewpoints so that audiences can evaluate our journalism accordingly? And is the Trump regime occasion to discard the rule book altogether? We asked you to call in with comments, and we got a lot of responses. For many of you, objectivity, or at least the outward appearance of it, must be preserved. So say Laura Rosenberg, Jordan Lieb, and Tess Sterling.
It would affect my opinion of a reporter if I knew they were at the March for Life or the Women's March, because you can't be in that environment and not be swayed.
I'm sure some members of the press have very strong personal views about certain issues, but more important than marching for those issues is reporting on them and arming the rest of us with the truth so we know exactly what we're marching for.
We need more neutrality in the way that news is presented in order to combat fake news and to give this populace that is, for the first time in maybe a long time, really, really engaged, something to hold on to and something to make their own decisions based on.
But for a lot of you, including Tebby Davis, Adam Lewis, and Penny Gage, the time has come for a change.
Journalists are human beings, and they must, by living, have an opinion, have a preconceived notion of right and wrong. Yes, I do believe the journalist would be well within their rights as an American citizen to protest, voice their opinion, whether it's on the air, off the air.
They are members of a society whose very existence is currently under threat, and they should be afforded the opportunity to participate.
Allowing reporters to peacefully and respectfully express these opinions in marches or by contacting their elected representatives helps them feel like their voice matters, even outside of their job.
Some of you said that the pretense of neutrality was far more irksome than the expression of opinions. Here's Gail Gatchalian, Elizabeth King, and Mark Otell.
When a reporter says, "I am objective," I'm almost more suspicious. But if they express their political opinion, I at least know where they're coming from and can use that information as an additional data point when interpreting the reporting.
Knowing that journalists do in fact have biases, I think that as consumers, we deserve to know what those biases are. Let us know how you really feel so that we can be better critical media consumers.
This idea that because you're a journalist, you need to be 24/7 serious, straight down the line, just the facts, ma'am, that just doesn't make any sense to me.
And finally, some of you said that neutrality was all well and good once upon a time, but for Greg Davis, at least, it's a luxury we can no longer afford.
The rules have changed a little bit since November, and we have to consider that quote, often misattributed to Dante, that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in times of great moral crisis, maintain their neutrality.
To all of you who sent us voice memos, and there were a lot of you, thank you very much. Okay, now we get meta, because On the Media is itself subject to all of the same concerns as the people we cover. And we've made some choices of our own that, criticism show or not, fly in the face of public radio norms. So we sought an audience with our boss, WNYC's Vice President for News, Jim Schachter, who has been obliged of late to clarify these issues in his newsroom.
It's hard. And I think that we have to be honest about the complexities of this and kind of compassionate in our thinking about it. I'm going to tell you a story about how this has gone through my mind over the last couple of weeks. So earlier this month, my wife and my three daughters all set off to Washington to the Women's March with their pink knit hats on their heads. And I said to them, you know, I'm going to, in public, ignore this. I'm not going to be posting on Facebook or tweeting or putting pictures up on Instagram that you send me from Washington, because you're going to engage in an act of politics and of criticism of the Trump administration that is anathema to me as a journalist. It's your right, but it's not my privilege as a journalist. And I was very clear on that in my own head. A week later, the restrictions on refugee resettlement and travel from Muslim countries came down the pike, and my head was a mess. My mother was a refugee from Nazi Germany. My wife's father was a refugee from Nazi Germany, and I found myself thinking, well, this is a human rights matter. This isn't a political matter. And then had an honest discussion with my wife and daughters where I said, you know, a week ago you were telling me that the Women's March was about human rights matters too. So I think we have to acknowledge the complexity of all this, and we have to be honest with our audiences about the complexities in our own mind and be decently transparent about that, and then make sure that we have not damaged our credibility in a way that stops us from doing the important work of journalism.
I wonder if there is some sort of inherent deception in the pretense, you know, for the public's view that we have no personal views that may or may not influence our coverage, or that we make professional judgments all the time that explicitly do influence our coverage. Is there dishonesty in our attempt to portray ourselves as journalistic automatons?
I think there's less and less evidence of our portraying ourselves that way. I was reading the New York Times this morning on my train ride to work and read a beautiful short piece by Helene Cooper, their Pentagon correspondent, telling the story of her family's exodus from Liberia after her mother was raped in the midst of a civil war there. And Helene clearly chose her words very carefully, but was telling a story about why she was empathetic to the people who found themselves last weekend stuck at airports around the world because of the president's executive order. Does that mean that Helene has now made it impossible for herself to continue covering the Pentagon for the New York Times? I don't think so. I think that her editors in allowing her to write that piece and then to publish it is saying, I'm a human being who is processing these events through the prism of my experience, both as a person and as a professional. And I think I see more and more and more of that going on, as opposed to what might be a past generation's pretense of neutrality.
In your early answers, if I am characterizing this right, you were couching it in terms of what outsiders might think if they see certain behaviors, see certain tweets, Instagram pictures of family members in pink knit caps and so forth. Not to suggest that our reputation doesn't matter. Obviously it does. But how much do the various ethics rules at news organizations like WNYC concern the perception of partisanship or unfairness versus the best way to gather and contextualize the news? Are we excessively focusing on the optics?
I don't think that I'm overly focused on the optics. To disclose to the audience of On the Media, a few days after the election in November, there were a lot of bruised feelings at WNYC. People were quite concerned and upset, and you know, there was a little bit of existential fear in the air, as I think there was in many newsrooms. And I didn't talk to the staff about the optics. I talked to the staff about what our role was in society. And our role in society is to do work in a way that people will believe what we found and what we've reported.
We have on our program done something closer to the primal scream that many people in the newsroom were suppressing the day after the election. How can I put this in a way that doesn't...
Is it hard to be your boss, Bob? Is that the question?
No. Well, I mean, yes, I know the answer to that question. I know our audience really appreciate this. They really respond to this. Is there a risk of feeding up more of what the audience seems genuinely to crave?
Well, if you're asking, is there a risk to journalists switching from a path of honest inquiry about matters of consequence to being dispensers of red meat to an audience that they train to be ever more bloodthirsty, I believe that question answers itself.
That was withering. On the other hand, the times, they are a-changing. And based on what we are experiencing now and the fact that we're even having this conversation, is this occasion to revisit the rules of ethics and conduct that have governed us for decades?
Here's what I've been saying to my staff. Can I imagine a time in America when we should lay down our pens and microphones and take up our swords? Because I think that's essentially what you're asking. Do we set aside the principles and values of journalism and engage in advocacy because we are at a moment where we need to, you know, mount the battlements? I can imagine that. Like I said, my mother is a refugee from Nazi Germany. It's not hard for me to imagine it at all. But once you've done that, you can't go back. So I think that vigilance and constant discussion and conversation about how we do our job, what our job is, how the job evolves, is absolutely in order. But it's not time.
Jim, thank you very much.
You bet. I'm always happy to come talk to you.
Jim Schachter is the Vice President of News for WNYC. Coming up, automating ourselves to death. Are secret algorithms undermining democracy? This is On the Media.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. And this is disgraced anchorman Howard Beale's live on the air tirade from the 1976 movie Network.
We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad.
Beale was raging against complacency, cheap titillation, and the conglomeratization of everything, including the media.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Writer Paddy Chayefsky's vision was dark and prescient. Soon enough, two real-life broadsides came to prominence, articulating similarly bleak visions of our media environment. Culture critic Neil Postman wrote Amusing Ourselves to Death, which observed that society was filling itself with narcotic drivel along brave new world lines and disengaging sleepily from civic life. Meantime, journalist-turned-academic Ben Bagdikian warned in his book, The Media Monopoly, about concentrated ownership's threat to democracy, and spent years sounding that alarm.
Of our 1,600 daily newspapers, about a dozen corporations now control more than half of all national daily circulation. Of our 11,000 magazines with individual titles, a half dozen corporations have most of the revenues. Of our 4 television networks and 900 commercial stations, 3 corporations have most of the audience and the revenues.
The result, he said, was an ever-shrinking universe of media corporations protecting their lucrative marketplace by limiting the marketplace of ideas to establishment voices and a narrow set of views. It was all pretty scary, but then, just in time, came...
On the internet, cyberspace, set free, hello virtual reality...
Interactive appetite, searching for a website, a window to the world, got to get online.
Take a spin, now you're in with the techno set, you're going surfing on the internet.
Not just the funnest ride ever, but the ultimate marketplace of ideas, the Mall of America of ideas, the Mall of the World of ideas, in which everyone has a voice and access to the information needed to guide a democratic society. As Vice President Al Gore explained.
This form of government became possible, according to many, only after the printing press distributed a sufficient quantity of civic knowledge to empower the average citizen to participate in the decisions that were necessary to guide the destiny of a great nation. If that was the case, then we can only imagine what advances for democracy lie in store.
But instead of delivering infinite diversity, Gore's information superhighway has been narrowed down to two lanes, Google and Facebook, which between them account for two-thirds of online advertising revenue. Two companies, two-thirds. And people worried about Time Warner and the Walt Disney Company.
This is not what I think the founders of the internet wanted, but it's the world we've got.
Jonathan Taplin, director emeritus of the Annenberg Innovation Lab at the University of Southern California, is author of the forthcoming book, Move Fast and Break Things, chronicling the damage wrought by the titans of Silicon Valley.
And so all of a sudden, what you have is a world in which there are two or three gatekeepers who have far more concentration of power than Walt Disney in its wildest imagination ever had.
You know, the first half advertising revenue numbers, I think, best frame this.
Jason Kent is CEO of Digital Content Next, a trade association for premium digital publishers.
The industry grew in the U.S. advertising market for digital about $5 billion in the first half of 2016. And Google took about 60% of those dollars, and Facebook took about 40%. So collectively, those two companies took 100% of the growth in the industry for the first half of the year. Facebook and Google, for the most part, don't create any content. And so 100% of the growth in the industry is going to two companies that don't create any content.
But they do have an audience of billions, and as such, they are by far the biggest distributors of news and news-like content in the world. This has some benefits, beginning with the enormous reach it gives publishers and the shared ad income that comes with it. It also has some positively dystopian disadvantages, mainly the ceding of distribution to third parties who have no journalistic or civic mission whatsoever. These tech companies' interest is keeping you personally glued to their platforms, a motive that doesn't lend itself to feeding users with the latest on Aleppo, the Flint drinking water calamity, or anything whatsoever taking place in your state house. What it favors is dresses that look gold and white to some people and black and blue to others, or Kanye's nervous breakdown, or fake news.
Welcome to the Hillary and Bill Clinton body count documentary. In this video, we're going to discuss the 114 people the Clintons have killed to keep quiet.
Fake news, of course, is not a 21st century invention. Indeed, before the mid-20th century professionalization of newspapering and decoupling from party affiliation, it was a staple of the press since the founding of the Republic. But what is unique to our times is the filter bubble of our Google News and Facebook pages, which, like lazy parents, keep feeding us more and more of what we like, whether good for us or not. You don't have to be an ivory tower academic to see how this can contaminate a democracy.
And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there.
Mind you, it's not that a bunch of soulless Silicon Valley capitalists are personally making terrible editorial decisions to serve us French fries and tendentious lies. That job is done by computer algorithms. Facebook's is called EdgeRank, that favor some content over others based on so-called engagement, what gets liked more, commented on more, shared more.
Things have to push emotional buttons with a whole lot of strength to really carry through Facebook's ecosystem.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia.
And the effect that it's having on us is clear. It is hurting our ability to operate as citizens in a republic. It's hurting our ability to make sense of the world. It's harming our ability to think through complex problems.
And it is devastating to publishers that do have a civic mission. This is an industry already reeling from the digital revolution, which reduced barriers to entry to nothing and created a ruinous glut of ad inventory. Since 1990, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. newspaper industry has shed almost 60% of its workforce, as revenue shrank by 72%. For all the lip service paid to doing more with less, the editorial cutbacks have been crippling. The population of State House reporters has halved since 1993, and half of those remaining work part-time. Foreign bureaus are all but extinct. Many papers, including the New York Times, have even stopped routinely covering crime, fires, and other quotidian calamity. Analog ad dollars of yore have been reduced to digital ad dimes, but even those increasingly depend on third parties. Because more than half of publishers' traffic does not come directly to their homepages, but via links in social media. And so, in cities around the country, in search of eyeballs and the ad revenue that comes with them, papers are scrambling to locate readers wherever they happen to be, and to serve them content which most intrigues them. This is the morning news meeting at the San Jose Mercury News. Eight editors around a conference table, others connecting via video link. The session begins, as always, with a rundown of what is trending on social media.
The Golden Globes were announced today. Susan Olsen, a Brady Bunch actress, fired after a phone call to Grant, and the December Supermoon.
Neil Chase is executive editor of the Bay Area News Group. He says the days of editorial mandarins dictating the news are long gone. Not only must the Mercury News take its content wherever the readers are, it must take it where the readers' interests are.
What's trending in terms of what's being talked about on other websites? Not so we can do the same things, but what are we missing? What are people talking about?
And if that means ending slavish adherence to a news agenda dictated by a calendar of government meetings and police reports, so be it.
There are certain stories that we will cover whether or not we think they're interesting to people. But there are also stories you look at and think, I don't know if we really needed to cover that story. Let's have a thoughtful conversation about whether that's the kind of news we should be covering. The second layer is, what's happening on our site? Which things did well over the past 24 hours or over the past weekend? What got people's attention? What didn't because we didn't write the headline the right way or we missed something? And if we're not thinking about every headline and writing it well, then we're not getting that story in front of as many people as want to see it.
Which, in a click economy, is what keeps the lights on. Stories that get seen generate ad revenue, however diminished. And maybe the reader will be drawn back to the newspaper's homepage, generating more page views. Maybe they'll sign up for a newsletter or buy a reprint. Every little bit helps. And every little bit, Chase emphasizes, subsidizes the expensive and generally less lucrative nuts and bolts reporting at the core of the newspaper's mission.
I know we will not be the 60-plus billion-dollar industry that we once were nationwide, but if you can come up with new ideas, new models to offset the drop in print revenue, you're keeping the business alive and stable and keeping the journalism happening for the people who need it.
It is that very holistic view that in the past 16 months enticed publishers to make the counterintuitive decision to surrender distribution of their content to third parties. Instead of the stories residing on the publisher's own sites, they live in the so-called walled gardens of Facebook Instant Articles, Google AMP, and Snapchat Discover. Custom content, handsomely designed and fast loading for mobile consumption. That's because it's piped in direct and thus unladen with the layers of tracking code and irrelevant bottom-feeding ads that bog down so much online content. In theory, it's a win-win-win. Better experience for users, exclusive content for the platforms, and a bonanza for publishers, who stand to enjoy both larger audiences and better ad rates that come with the tech platform's extraordinary targeting capacity. So where could the flaw be in that? Okay, so the Silicon Valley juggernauts keep all the new audience data for themselves, refusing to relinquish to publishers the very commodity that enables them to target directly. And sure, the algorithms still favor the fluffy or the incendiary or the otherwise highly emotional over reporting substance. And, yeah, the algorithmic suppression of expensive-to-produce serious journalism creates a financial disincentive for publishers to spend on serious journalism to begin with. But the money! Yeah, that sucks too. According to a Digital Content Next study leaked by an association member to Business Insider, the average first-year revenue to publishers from third-party distributors was $7.7 million, or only 14% on average of their overall income. Now, if you're going to sell your journalistic soul, shouldn't you get more out of the Faustian bargain? Eamon Storr, until leaving this week for a venture in corporate social responsibility, was CEO of the Guardian US newspaper. Almost all of the value of this dedicated content, he says, accrues to the platforms, companies that operate in total opacity and have demonstrated little regard for the effect of the filter bubble.
And I think people like Facebook have a very real responsibility for, aside from whatever it was in the last quarter, 7 billion, I can't remember, it was billions of revenue, with very little account for the way you are shaping the future of society. And I think New York Times is seeing this, The Post is seeing this, and others. If we do what the ad industry wants, we should create more fluffy stuff in safer territories and push it all through a pipe for a minimum amount of revenue and just try and deliver volume for low cost, right? That's essentially what the ad industry is asking for. Senior agency people are telling their clients to avoid The Guardian because the news cycle is too dark right now.
This, says Storr, is the toll of putting
way too much power with a very select group of people.
Media concentration is not just bad social policy, says internet pioneer Tim Berners-Lee. It is bad architecture, antithetical to the history and healthy future of online life. Quote, close to the principle of universality is that of decentralization, which means that no permission is needed from a central authority to post anything on the web. There is no central controlling node and no single point of failure. But if Berners-Lee is right, and Bagdikian was right, and Vaidyanathan and Taplin are right, and if the temple has been overrun by the moneylenders, and partly for that reason a new dark period of political history has been ushered in, wherein too much power has indeed been usurped by a small number of people, the irony is thick. Back in the 1940s, the computer age itself was ushered in, largely according to the ethos of the philosopher-mathematician Norbert Wiener, father of cybernetics. Wiener, says Stanford University communications professor Fred Turner, sought safe haven for democratic discourse in the wake of 15 years of fascism via the same architecture we now disparagingly call the filter bubble.
In which freedom was imagined as being able to build your own feedback loops, as being able to enter into the world, seek the information that you needed, learn from it, and then change your action accordingly. In many ways, Google is the dream of Norbert Wiener from the 1940s realized. The trouble is, once realized, it doesn't necessarily bring us democracy. It brings us a new and different mode of authoritarian enclosure.
An unintended consequence of utopian engineering, you might say, like genetic modifications going haywire in the wild, or on the subject of automating ourselves to death, Dr. Strangelove's doomsday machine.
Because of the automated and irrevocable decision-making process, which rules out human meddling, the doomsday machine is terrifying. It's simple to understand and completely credible and convincing.
Convincing, like a dubious business proposition that sounds like a good business proposition. Convincing, like an invented presidential endorsement from the Pope in Rome. Convincing, like cyber sirens luring us to their irresistible but fatal pleasures. Odysseus lashed himself to his mast to fight that temptation. Howard Beale became unhinged. Us? Whether we wind up surrendering to the awesome power of the machine or raging against it, What we must do at least is be sure we understand its perils. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Meera Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Michael Lowinger, Sara Kari, Leia Feder, and Kate Bakhtiarova. And our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Terrence Bernardo. Jim Schachter is WNYC's Vice President for News. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.